Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Okay, let's dive right in. Here's something to think about. When a species adapts, like really quickly, to a totally new environment, maybe moving way up a mountain or suddenly dealing with a new disease, how much of that success is brand new DNA? And how much is, well, borrowed from somewhere else?
That borrowed DNA idea is key. We call it introgression. And it's like an evolutionary accelerator. It's essentially the transfer of genes across different lineages.
So populations can sort of cheat evolution, skip the millions of years it might take for the right mutation to pop up.
Exactly. They borrow a ready-made solution.
Right. And, you know, we often think of this in terms of ancient history, like the Neanderthal DNA many humans carry. But the work we're looking at today shows this isn't just some old story. It's happening now. It's a major driver of adaptation across, well, all sorts of life.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The footprints of this borrowed DNA, they're showing up in really critical places. We're talking genes for immunity, for reproduction, even for adapting to extreme environments. Think high altitude adaptation in Tibetan people, for instance.
Okay, so if it's this fundamental, this important, the big question is obvious. How do we actually find these tiny bits of borrowed DNA hidden in a huge genome? I imagine that's pretty tricky.
It absolutely is. And that's really the core of what we're digging into. Today, we're celebrating the work summarized by Shen Huang, Joseph Hackel, and Martin Kuhlwelm. The recent review, Decoding Genomic Landscapes of Introgression, really pushes forward our understanding of the methods we need to spot these genomic segments.
Which brings us squarely to the challenge. It's not just about finding a piece of foreign DNA, right? It's about understanding the whole picture. The landscape, as they call it, how these borrowed bits are kept or lost or spread out. And that landscape is shaped by, well, some really complex forces.
That's it, exactly. There are at least three big ones interacting. First, you've got the demographic history, you know, how populations moved, merged, split apart, it gets messy.
Yeah.
Then there's selective pressure. Is this borrowed gene actually helpful or harmful or neutral that drastically changes its fate?
All right.
And finally, the underlying genomic architecture itself matters. Things like how DNA is structured, where recombination happens frequently or rarely, that influences whether borrowed chunks stick around or get broken up.
And early on, researchers tackled this mostly in humans and our archaic relatives, I guess, because that's where we had the best data first.
Pretty much. But now we're seeing this explosion of genomic data from, I mean, everything. Hickories, peafowls, corn earworms, baboons, you name it. And that huge increase in diversity demands new, more powerful tools to map these introgression landscapes properly.
Okay, before we get into the actual tools, let's quickly pin down the terms.
Yeah.
There are different types of introgression we need to look for.
Right. So the main umbrella term is just introgression. That's simply the gene transfer between lineages. Basic concept.
Got it.
Then there's adaptive introgression. This is more specific. It's when that gene flow happens and the borrowed gene variant is actually beneficial. So natural selection favors it, helps it spread quickly in the new population.
That's the evolutionary fast track you mentioned.
Exactly. And the third one, this one's really intriguing, ghost introgression.
Ghost. Okay, sounds mysterious.
It kind of is. This refers to gene flow from a population that's, well, extinct, or maybe just one we haven't sampled yet. It's missing from our data sets.
So how do you even find evidence of it then?
Indirectly, we can only see the patterns it left behind in the genomes of the populations that did receive those genes. We infer its existence.
Wow, okay. So given this complexity, huge data sets, adaptive pressures, these ghost populations, how do researchers actually go about detecting introgression? The review seems to break it down into three main methodological camps.
That's right. You've got summary statistics, probabilistic modeling, and then supervised learning, which is basically machine learning.
Let's start with the summary statistics. Sounds like the simplest approach.
Conceptually, yes. They're great for getting a first look for exploratory analysis. They basically boil down complex patterns in the genome, like how common certain alleles are, or how genes are linked into straightforward numbers.
The classic example everyone learns first is the D statistic, right? The Abby-Ababa test.
That's the one. It's very useful for detecting if introgression happens somewhere in the genome based on shared derived alleles, but it's not great at telling you exactly where the introgressed bit is.
Ah, so it gives you a genome-wide signal, but struggles with specific locations. the loci.
Precisely. And it can also be a bit biased, especially in parts of the genome with low genetic diversity.
So people developed ways to improve on that for finding specific spots.
Yes, several refinements. Tools like FD, DF, and D+ were developed. They essentially adjust or scale the D-statistic signal in clever ways to try and reduce that bias and get better resolution to pinpoint the actual introgressed segments.
And what about specifically finding that adaptive introgression, the stuff that's being actively selected for?
For that, there are specialized stats too, like U and Q. The idea behind these is to specifically look for and retain patterns involving rare variants that are shared between the population you're studying and the potential source population. It helps enrich your list of candidates for genes that were likely beneficial.
Makes sense. And what if you're dealing with more complex scenarios, like gene flow between multiple populations, not just a simple donor-recipient pair?
Good point. For situations with, say, more than four populations, you might turn to topology-based methods, tools like TWIST and its successor, TWIST2.
Topology, like the shape of the evolutionary tree.
Exactly. These methods look at the evolutionary trees calculated for small windows of the genome. If the tree for a particular chunk of DNA disagrees with the overall species tree, meaning the relationships look different in that spot, that's a strong hint that introgression might have happened there.
Okay, so summary stats are useful, but maybe struggle when things get really complex or noisy, which naturally leads to the next camp. Probabilistic modeling. How is that different?
Fundamentally different approach. Instead of just summarizing observed patterns, probabilistic models try to explicitly model the underlying evolutionary processes. Things like mutation rates, recombination frequencies, changes in population size over time.
So they build a mathematical story of how the DNA could have evolved.
Sort of, yeah. They use that model to calculate likelihoods or perform Bayesian inference. It's a much more rigorous, statistically principled framework.
Do you give an example?
Sure. A method like IBDMIX estimates the probability that two DNA segments in different individuals are identical because they were inherited from a recent common ancestor, what we call identity by descent, or IBD.
Right.
What's neat about IBDMIX is that it often doesn't require you to have a definite, non-introgressed reference population to compare against, which can be a huge practical advantage when you're studying wild populations.
Okay, that sounds powerful. What about those really tricky cases like the adaptive introgression from a ghost population you mentioned earlier?
Yes. For that specific complex scenario, there's a likelihood-based tool called Volcano Finder.
Volcano Finder. Why the name?
It looks for a very specific pattern of genetic diversity around the potentially adaptive gene. It expects to see reduced diversity right at the selected site because the beneficial genes swept through, flanked on either side by elevated diversity, leftovers from the introgression event. This dip surrounded by peaks looks a bit like a volcano cross-section.
Huh. That sounds incredibly specific, though, almost rigid. What if the real history wasn't exactly like that perfect volcano scenario?
That is exactly its main weakness. You hit it right there. Volcano Finder is built on a very specific demographic model. It assumes the beneficial allele became common in the source population before it introgressed and then swept again in the recipient population. If the evolutionary steps happened in a slightly different order or if the selection wasn't quite that strong,
the tool might miss it completely or give a wrong answer.
It struggles, yeah. Its performance can drop significantly if reality deviates from its built-in assumptions.
So that highlights a trade-off. Some models are flexible, but maybe less powerful. Others are powerful for specific scenarios, but lack flexibility. What about going really deep into the details of ancestry? I think you mentioned something called ancestral recombination graphs.
ARGs, yes. ARG-based methods like ARG-ARD represent the absolute gold standard in terms of detail. They try to reconstruct the full ancestry of the sampled genomes, including every recombination event that separated different parts of the chromosomes throughout history.
Wow, that sounds intensive.
It is. ARG-ARD, for instance, has been used successfully to detect introgression from a really ancient, super archaic ghost population into the Denisovans. It gives you incredibly fine-grained resolution.
But there's always a but, isn't there? What's the catch with ARGs?
The catch is computational cost. It's enormous.
Too slow for big data sets.
Massively too slow for the kind of population scale data sets we have now. Building these full GIF, especially within a Bayesian framework like AR Griever D uses, just doesn't scale well enough for analyzing hundreds or thousands of whole genomes. It's computationally prohibitive for many projects.
Okay, so that computational wall must be a big reason why researchers have turned so enthusiastically to the third category.
Yeah.
Supervised learning or machine learning.
Absolutely. Traditional methods, especially the complex probabilistic ones, can really bog down with the sheer size and the high dimensionality of modern genomic data. Machine learning offers a way to handle that scale and complexity more effectively.
The key difference with supervised ML, though, is that it needs to be trained first, right? It needs examples where it knows the right answer.
Yeah.
How do you get that for introgression? You can't just label real genomes perfectly.
Exactly. So researchers rely heavily on simulations. They create artificial genomes using computer models where they know precisely which segments are integressed and which aren't. This simulated data with its known labels becomes the ground truth used to train the ML model.
The model learns the patterns associated with integration in the simulations.
And then hopefully it can recognize similar patterns in the real unlabeled data.
And are there different ways these ML methods work?
Broadly, yes. Some ML methods still use summary statistics like those FD values or diversity measures as their input features. Tools like ArcGIS or Maladapt fall into this category. Others take a more direct approach.
How so?
They're designed to automatically learn the important features directly from the raw genetic data, like the genotype matrix itself, without needing pre-calculated statistics. Erica and Genomat are examples here.
And you mentioned one called Intranet that sounded particularly cutting edge, using ideas from computer vision.
Right. Intranet frames the problem differently. It treats detecting introgressed segments along a chromosome as a semantic segmentation task.
Okay, what does that mean in plain English?
Think about image analysis, like identifying a cat in a photo. Semantic segmentation doesn't just put a box around the cat. It tries to label every single pixel as either cat or not cat.
So it outlines the exact shape.
Precisely. Intranet tries to do the same for genomes. It aims to classify each individual allele or very small genomic window as introgressed or not introgressed. This allows for potentially much higher resolution mapping of where the borrowed DNA starts and stops compared to methods that look at larger chunks.
That's really cool. Okay, so we've covered the three main approaches: stats, probabilistic models, and ML. Let's talk impact. Are these tools actually finding important stuff in the real world beyond just human evolution?
Oh, definitely. The applications are really diverse now. Summary statistics are still workhorses. For instance, researchers used FDM, one of those scaled D statistics combined with the scans for selection, to pinpoint genes related to flowering time in Brassica napus, that's rapeseed or canola.
Important for agriculture, then.
Hugely. And those adaptive stats, U and Q, they helped find genes involved in sperm function in stickleback fish, known for rapid adaptation, and also candidate genes for high altitude adaptation in Tibetan cattle.
And the probabilistic methods.
Also proving very versatile. IBD mix, which we talked about, has been used to map out introgressed fragments in wild baboons and even bears. And methods based on hidden Markov models, like HEMIX, have been crucial for detecting that tricky ghost introgression.
Where have they found ghost signals?
In some really interesting places. Orcas, various dog relatives or canids, and even in the extinct Colombian mammoth. It's like finding echoes of lost populations.
And connecting back, you mentioned the EPAS1 gene for high altitude adaptation.
Yes, there's evidence suggesting the version found in Tibetan canids, wolves, and dogs might have come from a ghost lineage. It's intriguingly parallel to the human story, where the high altitude version of EPA1 in Tibetans came from Denisovans.
That's a striking convergence.
Yeah.
It really underscores how often evolution seems to borrow good ideas.
It does. And even Volcano Finder, despite its rigid assumptions, has had successes. It helped identify potentially adaptive ghost introgression related to bitter taste perception in gorillas, and also found loci linked to important commercial traits in domestic pigs. The power of adaptive introgression is just undeniable across the board.
Okay, so the toolkit is powerful and growing, and the discoveries are exciting. But let's be realistic. These methods aren't magic bullets, are they? What are the big challenges that still make this work difficult?
No, definitely not magic bullets. There are significant hurdles. The first major one is confounding factors. Other evolutionary processes can create genomic patterns that look a lot like introgression, even when it didn't happen.
Such as?
The classic confounder is incomplete lineage sorting, or ILS. This happens when ancestral genetic variation persists through speciation events. So sister species might share alleles just because they haven't had time to sort out differently yet, not because of recent gene flow.
Ah, so a shared variant could just be an old leftover, not a new borrowing. Teasing those apart must be tough.
Extremely tough, especially when looking further back in time. Another tricky one is long-term balancing selection.
How does that confuse things?
Balancing selection actively maintains different alleles in a population over very long periods. This maintenance of old variation can create patterns, like elevated diversity or unusual gene trees, that mimic introgression, especially adaptive introgression.
Right. Then there are the limitations of the models themselves, which we touched on.
Exactly. We talked about Volcano Finder's specific demographic assumptions. Other tools have similar issues. SPRIME, for example, another method, apparently has parameters hard-coded in its implementation that are quite specific to the Neanderthal admixture event in humans leaving Africa.
Which means it might not work well, or might need significant tweaking, for studying, say, introgression between two fish species.
Potentially, yes. And for the machine learning methods, their biggest vulnerability is the reliance on simulations for training.
If the simulation doesn't accurately reflect the real population's history,
the model's performance can plummet. It might learn artifacts of the simulation rather than the true signal of introgression. It fails to generalize. That's a huge concern.
Okay, and what about practical hands-on limitations?
Yeah.
Things that stop researchers from even using some of these advanced tools on their organisms.
A major one, especially for non-model organisms, basically, anything that isn't a lab mouse or human or fruit fly, is the need for haplotype phasing.
Right. Can you explain what that is again and why it's such a bottleneck?
Sure. So most organisms we study are diploid, meaning they have two copies of each chromosome, one from each parent. Haplotype phasing is the process of figuring out, for a given individual, which genetic variants are physically located together on the same chromosome copy.
So, knowing which variants came from mom's chromosome versus dad's chromosome.
Exactly. Many of the sophisticated probabilistic and machine learning methods require this phased haplotype information as input. But actually getting accurate phasing is computationally hard and often requires large reference panels of already phased genomes, which just don't exist for most species.
So if you're studying, I don't know, a rare orchid or an Antarctic fish, you might be stuck using the simpler summary statistics because you can't phase your data well enough for the fancier methods.
That is often the reality, yes.
Mm.
It limits the applicability of the most advanced tools. And there's another layer. Most tools are built assuming diploidy.
Meaning they don't work for organisms with more than two sets of chromosomes?
Correct. Think polyploidy. Many plants, including incredibly important crops like wheat or cotton, are polyploid. Most current introgression detection software just isn't designed to handle that complexity. It's a major gap, especially for agricultural genomics.
Okay, so we have confounding factors like ILS, model limitations, the simulation dependence of ML, and practical hurdles like phasing and polyploidy. Given all that, where does the field go next? If no single method is perfect, how do we move forward?
I think the clear path forward involves complementarity, recognizing that each approach has strengths and weaknesses.
So using them together.
Precisely. You might use the fast, efficient summary statistics for an initial genome-wide scan. Then perhaps use more rigorous probabilistic models to validate the most promising signals. And maybe bring in machine learning, like Intranet, for really high-resolution mapping of the validated segments.
An integrated toolkit approach, basically.
Exactly. Combining the interpretability and speed of stats, the principled inference of models, and the scalability and fine mapping ability of ML. Alongside this, there's a huge need for more transparency and standardization.
How so?
We need reproducible workflows so others can run the same analysis. And we desperately need systematic benchmarking studies that fairly compare different methods on the same data sets, both simulated and real. That's the only way to really understand why different studies sometimes get conflicting results using different tools.
And looking further out, any new technologies on the horizon?
Well, there's a lot of excitement around adapting methods from natural language processing. Things like genomic language models or other self-supervised learning techniques.
Oh, that helped.
The key potential benefit is that these self-supervised methods can learn patterns directly from the massive amounts of raw sequence data without needing pre-labeled training examples, without relying on those potentially biased simulations. This could lead to more robust models that generalize better across diverse species and histories.
Interesting. So wrapping this part up, the main takeaway seems to be that finding intergress DNA has become a really sophisticated field. There's no single magic answer.
Not at all. It's about smartly combining different tool stats, models, ML, each suited for different parts of the problem.
And the goal of all this complex methodology?
It's ultimately about getting a clearer, more accurate picture of how evolution really works, how this borrowing of genes, this introgression, has shaped the diversity of life we see today, especially how it fuels adaptation and allows us to trace deep, sometimes hidden, evolutionary connections.
Which leads perfectly into a final thought for you, our listeners, to ponder. With these improving tools constantly refining our view of gene flow, even from ghosts of the past, what does this ultimately mean for our ability to reconstruct the complete evolutionary tree of life, including those extinct and unsampled populations? This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.